GW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. Sources tell ABC News President Biden is now considering preemptive pardons for current and former officials the Trump administration might go after.
People like Dr. Anthony Fauci, of course, a lightning rod for Republicans with everything around COVID. General Mark Milley, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who Republicans have blamed over the withdrawal from Afghanistan, as well as members of the January 6th Select Committee, people like Liz Cheney, Adam Schiff.
ABC's Mary Alice Parks. Honda recalling more than 200,000 late model Pilot and Passport sport utes, and improper connection in the fuel line makes it vulnerable to breaking apart in crashes, leading to a fuel leak and possible fire. Baseball, Chicago White Sox announced the death of retired slugging third baseman Bill Melton after a short illness. His 33 home runs in 1970 made him the first Sox player to blast 30 or more. Bill Melton was 79 years old. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.FM.
The Bucks' winning streak comes to an end. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks lost at home to the Hawks 119-104. That snapped the Bucks' seven-game winning streak. The Hawks have now won five in a row. Doc Rivers said after playing the Pistons in Detroit the night before, the Bucks looked tired.
I thought we were dead-legged most of the game. You know, we didn't think well, which is a direct sign of fatigue. Our passes were really late.
College volleyball. Six players from the Badgers women's team named to the Big Ten All-Conference team. And for the second year in a row, the Badgers' Sarah Franklin named Big Ten Player of the Year. NFL, the Green Bay Packers on Thursday Night Football. Lucas Van Ness before boarding the team flight on what to expect from the Lions and the Packers.
We know it's going to be a physical brand of football. I think over there in Detroit and here in Green Bay, we're both two football teams that, you know, want to come out and play a physical brand of football and kind of just dominate you.
That's Packers defensive end Lucas Van Ness. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Ho-ho, the holidays are here, and it's time to pick a present from the grown-up gift list with Civic Media's statewide text-to-win contest. Listen while you work for the keywords to text for your chance to win $100 cash, an overnight vacation at Chula Vista Resort, and be entered to win one of the grand prizes, a robot vacuum, new luggage, humidifier, espresso machine, and more on the grown-up gift list at civicmedia.us. Just download the Civic Media app and listen weekdays at 7, 11, 1, and 4 for your chance to win starting Monday morning. Ho-ho-ho!
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. So on Wednesday morning in Midtown Manhattan, Brian Thompson, the 50-year-old CEO of United Healthcare, was shot and killed by a masked gunman in front of a Hilton hotel on 54th Street, where he was to speak to investors. The New York Police Commissioner said that this was a premeditated, pre-planned, targeted attack. This was not random. And, you know, yesterday on the program, we talked about United Healthcare. One of the things we talked about extensively is how we're privatizing Medicare, how this is going to be the potentially the new Medicare, and how they have this practice of denying, denying, and denying. And Alex Lawson had a term for that. And this company was at the forefront of all of this. So I found it interesting that the next day after I have this conversation, that this man is murdered. Now, everyone from the hotels to the company, to United Healthcare, to left-leaning commentaries, to everybody, they've issued statements condemning the shooting and saying how saddened they are by the tragedy, you know, all that. The same thing, the thoughts and prayers generally that you get. Now, the New York police department. We're going to leave no stone unturned. We're going to climb every mountain. We're going to do everything. But on the saddened part, on the condemning part, I don't know that I can or will say that I'm saddened or condemn this yet because, well, I don't know all the details as of this moment. I don't know who killed this CEO. It wasn't me. But I think I can make an educated guess. Again, it wasn't me. But I think I'm beginning to understand. I personally, as you know, am in a major healthcare kind of crisis. My wife being in a hospital that is trying to get her out, blaming the insurance companies, a system set up by insurers to ensure that you get out the door as fast as possible, costing them as little as possible. I am beginning to understand the desperation. I'm beginning to understand how difficult it is. And understand, I have the best health insurance you're ever going to get. I don't have the pressures that the vast majority of people would have in the situation that I'm in. But I do feel the stress of the behemoth insurance companies and what they put on healthcare. So as I said, I don't know who did this. I don't know why, but I can make an educated guess. The idea that a loved one has passed because of a denial. The idea that someone may be suffering from cancer and being repeatedly denied care to save their lives. I kind of get it. I understand desperation. And this is what happens when you set up systems that create the kind of desperation that would lead someone potentially to murder someone on a street, wait them out, plan to do it in a premeditated, targeted fashion. That takes some serious planning, some serious commitment, and some serious desperation. And, you know, the argument that we heard a lot, remember during the 80s when the anti-abortion people were knocking off doctors, were murdering doctors in their driveways, saying we're protecting babies? I got to tell you, part of my mind goes, is this going to be that in this era? Can this shooter claim self-defense, for instance? They have an insurance policy that's trying to kill him. They were only defending their own lives. And I know it may sound odd, but I can understand. I can see how you can come to the conclusion that if there is care out there to be had that could prolong and save your life, and this entity is denying that care, that opportunity, I can see how you can go, there's the bad guy. And this CEO, being the head of this company that is making these decisions, he could choose a separate direction. He could choose to go a different route. He could choose different policies. He could pursue a different course of action. I can see it. And understand, we're in a very angry moment in this country. Anger got Donald Trump put into the White House. Anger is what has fueled most of our political debate. Because look, people are struggling. Families are having a hard time putting food on the table, keeping a roof over their heads, fighting with insurance companies. People are angry. And do I condone this behavior? No, I don't condone it. I understand it. Do I condemn it? No, I don't think I do. Because we could make different choices. But I do understand. And this is one of those moments where, is this a one-off? Is this one thing that happened, one person? Or when all the bad stuff that I've been saying the last several days starts to happen, as the policies Trump and Musk and the billionaire class heap on the rest of us in the working class who are struggling, who are feeling pain, who are angry, will we see more of this? Because to me, this reeks of populist anger. This reeks of someone saying, I've tried to play by the system. I've tried to play by the rules. We will see. As I've said, could this be a one-off? Or could this be the story we see more often? Is this going to be one of those moments where CEOs across industries start going, hey, maybe we don't continue what we've been doing. Maybe we pay workers a decent wage. Maybe we created a healthcare system that ensures people get care when they need it. Maybe we create an education system that doesn't put people in a lifetime of debt. Maybe we do all of those things and put a safety net under people's feet so when bad things happen, they aren't desperate. And again, I come back to myself. My wife and I, our family, has done everything that we believed was right. We played by the rules, and potentially for that, we could be bankrupt because of a system that is set up to ensure the wealthy get wealthier and the workers of this country, well, end up poor and desperate. So do I condone it? No. Do I condemn it? I don't think, I'm not going to go there yet. So I'm hoping that this is a wake-up call to corporate America. I'm hoping that this is a moment where we, as a nation, start having a different conversation, especially around the idea of completely privatizing something like Medicare, because we know what the gimmicks are. We know what the playbook is. We know how the profiteers have played us against each other. Do I feel for this man's family? Yes, I do. I feel for his children. I feel for his wife. I feel for him. Ultimately, I care about people. But I don't know. But I don't know that I condemn it. And I know that is a harsh, harsh statement. And I don't say that lightly. Because here's the part that I find most egregious. That person went to bed every night knowing that denying people care cost them their lives. And if I were the person who did this, and I'm not, the argument I think I would be making would be self-defense. They knew what they were doing. They fill in the blank. And I was defending myself. I was defending my family. I think that's an argument. I want to hear your thoughts, though. What do you think? Are we saddened? Or can we not talk about this in this frame? Should I be ousted? Or does it kind of make sense that I don't condone it, but I'm not right there yet to condemn it? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I want to hear your thoughts.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So recently, the Department of Labor proposed a new rule. The idea that maybe we should end the sub-minimum wage for people with disabilities. Something, you know, we've been talking about on this show for a while. I say it all the time. Work is work. It should have dignity. It should have respect. And you should be paid something that you can live on. And you look at some of these quote-unquote jobs for people with disabilities,
And it's almost as bad as if they were waiters and waitresses with no tips. And I fear, look, I give the Biden administration credit, proposing this, putting it forward through the Department of Labor. But I fear, much like the heat standard that they've proposed, it's going to get reversed by the Trump administration, and we're going to end up getting nothing done for working people. Because trust me, Trump is not the ally in this. But here to share some thoughts on what this proposal is and maybe how we push the Trump administration to hold on to it, because it is important. I've asked Julia Metro to come talk with us. She's a reporter over at Mother Jones. She covers disability and public health. Julia, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. So yesterday morning, it was a big surprise. The Department of Labor released a rule that they're proposing that some minimum wage for disability. So how that works is companies get certificates, and under these certificates, they can pay disabled people who are mostly people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, like autism, for example. You can pay them cents an hour. There are some states that have moved to get rid of this on their own, but it's still nationally allowed. This has been a thing since 1938, and it just hasn't gone away. But as much as our view on disability has evolved, I mean, a lot of disabled people used to be locked in institutions and never let out. I think it's a good time to question this as well. I'd say I was surprised that this was introduced, considering there have been discussions and conversations from the Department of Labor for, I'd say, a little over a year that they were considering addressing the 14C certificate program. And there were rumors that it would happen starting in August, and it's December, and it was finally introduced. And of course, we have to see whether or not the rule is made final. And that's a lot. And I know some people have expressed frustration that why now, when we know very soon that there's going to be a new administration where Donald Trump has expressed not good views on disabled people, including a family member saying he should just die. So, yeah, there's a lot of concerns for sure.
No, there's a lot of concerns. But, you know, some would say that, you know, this is what the Biden administration was thinking they would get to in the second term. This was that kind of when they made their roadmap. This is one of those things that they thought they would have time for. And, well, sadly, we don't. So, or do you agree with that or not? I guess I should start there.
Yeah, what I'll say is Biden did run on this in 2020. So this could have started to get underway much earlier.
Yeah.
And the Obama administration actually put an advisory committee together where they did talk to, and on this committee, there were people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and they looked at some minimum wage for disabled people, which it just, something that you can pay people less because they are a member of a protected class. It's very confusing. And they said this just doesn't make sense with modern law. And now in 2024, this rule was proposed, which is groundbreaking considering this has been allowed since 1938, which very long time. We're closer to 100 years than we are 50 years of this thing.
Yeah, no. What do you say to the person then who says, well, if you do away with this, nobody will hire people with disabilities? That the reason that they have this sub wage is that, you know, they get, you know, maybe Social Security disability, maybe they have some kind of other income, that this is just an incentive for employers to hire people.
Yeah, so there is actually a study that came out last month from University of Pennsylvania researchers, which looked at two states that did get rid of some minimum wage. Say it's New Hampshire and Maryland, and they found that those jobs did not go away. And so that kind of discredits that argument. And I also think if we look at the purpose of working, we work to make a living, we work to be able to afford things. If you're making 25 cents an hour, that is not the case. I also think there are other questions like the Social Security limits. Like, I do think that should be addressed as well. And I think you're hard to find any disability advocates who disagrees. And one thing that I'll also bring up is that every state has something called vocational rehabilitation services. So if you're a disabled person, you can receive training on work on like finding a job and how to perform well in this job for free. This already exists. So we already have some tools in place in a lot of the states that have gotten rid of some minimum wage. And what this what the rule is proposing and how it's been done in other states is that they phase it out. So it's not, things aren't disappearing overnight.
Right. So you said a second ago that people are being paid like a quarter an hour. Is that actually happening? Because I don't know. This is the reason I ask. Because it seems like why would you even bother waking up and going somewhere? I think bus fare would be more costly than working.
Yeah, that is definitely something. And an argument that I've largely seen from non-disabled parents of disabled people is, this is what my kid does all day to socialize. There's volunteering, there's community centers, there's other things to do that involve socializing. And also, if we just look at the history, so what a lot of these sheltered workshops where people are working, they just do, a lot of the time, they do one skill, putting certain things into boxes or something like that. Goodwill has applied for a lot of these certificates over the years, if you want an example of a company that does that. If you look at the history of assembly lines, for example, there have been concerns and criticism of that system. It's people aren't actually learning skills that help them move forward in the field. Like Henry Ford did not, the creator of assembly lines, did not care about that. A lot of these sheltered workshops, I'm not saying all of them, but some of them really do not teach people skills.
Right.
And that's a huge problem as well.
But the argument I would have back to that is, you know, work is what it is. You go to work to make a living. My employer doesn't have to teach me anything. They have to pay me for what I do for them and the value that I bring to them. And my argument, I don't care if you're doing assembly line work or brain surgery, you should be able to make a living at it. So for me, the argument is not so much that it's an assembly line kind of, you know, rote, boring job. Is I can't put food on my table. I can't keep a roof over my head, can't put clothes on my back, I can't even get to freaking work for what I'm paying here. That seems to me the most argument. No,
that is true, but under the certificate program, there is supposed to be training. Like, that is how this program is set up. That is supposed to happen. Everyone deserves to make an income that they can not only survive with but have a comfortable life. That doesn't happen with a lot of people. And that doesn't happen with minimum wage, even in a lot of parts of this country. And so we're looking, there was a report from a federal agency in January 2023 that found that half the people working in these sheltered workshops, which disabled advocates also criticize, because it's essentially places where only disabled people are working, so they're segregated from everyone else. But half those people are making less than $350 an hour. That's not livable.
No, it's not. It's not even close to livable. And there should not be we can make the argument that no one should make 7.25 because it's not livable. We should be having a much larger conversation. Clearly, this is a huge component, but the much larger compensation, the most larger conversation is the working class of this country, especially at the lower end, has been getting screwed for, well, decades, if not longer. And maybe we should be addressing that as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I also think it's important to recognize that disabled people are more likely to live in poverty than non-disabled people. And programs like 14C contribute to this as well. And the reality is, a lot of well-meaning parents are told this is the only path for their kids. And so they might encourage them to take this path. But that's not the only path. We know each state has vocational rehabilitation. Some states are much better than others. All states, of course, can be better in offering assistance and training and working. But that exists, and it can be utilized, and it's really an ableist frame of thinking that, oh, disabled people don't bring as much to the table. And like I said, it's people in these workshops, it's mostly people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, so they don't deserve the dignity of even making minimum wage.
And that's to me what this is all about. I mean, it's about dignity ultimately. And I think every person should have the ability to make a living. And this is where I've always said, if the private sector can't, or more likely won't, create enough jobs for everyone to have jobs when they want and need it, because I do believe everyone has to work. I've never believed in handout programs. I think if you want to eat, you got to work. That's an old school mentality, I know. But if the private sector won't, or say they can't, this is where the public sector has to. We have to create jobs for people to be able to make a dignified living. And that conversation's about, you know, what number is a livable wage, to keep a roof over your head, food on the table, you know, clothes on your back, some dignity, and then, you know, the old bread and roses frame. Yeah, those basic things, yes, but some of the nice things occasionally too. So for me, this is a much bigger conversation than one proposal that sadly a billionaire and his administration are going to throw into the trash can. It's about a much bigger argument for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And also the reality is a lot of people don't know this exists. Every time I've written an article on some minimum wage for disabled people, people are shocked. Of course, people know about it for waiters, but they have no idea this has been a law that has continued to exist. And many would argue it's discriminatory and is dehumanizing as well.
No, look, before I knew anyone who was seriously disabled and trying to get into the workforce, and I know a couple people who have serious disabilities. My one friend is blind and is probably, I call him Superman, or my producer calls him Mr. Wizard, because the guy can fix anything. He can put his hands on it. He can fix it. And he has a hard time getting anyone to hire him. And the disability payments that he gets because he's blind are pathetic. I have no idea, how anyone is expected to live on a couple hundred bucks a month. And then throw this on top of it. There's no living to be had here. So as someone who, I always thought that, you know what, you're being taken care of through disability. This is just something to give you dignity to show up to do. You get a little bit of money for it. That's great. It's an add-on. But the more I've learned, the worse this system seems to me.
Yeah. And I think that I'm not saying there was the worst intentions when it was set up in 1938. There was a very different views on disability at the time. Like I said, a lot of people were just institutionalized because that was seen as the proper thing to do. But as things move on, laws can change. We can change the laws. And I would say,
and Donald Trump
has not said anything against ending set minimum wage. So I think a hope is he just won't care enough to stop it, stop this rule from being finalized. I think that's a possibility. I know a lot of people are hoping that. The nominee for the Department of Labor hasn't said anything against it, but also hasn't said anything for it. Project 2025, which has been seen by some as the rule book for the Trump administration, doesn't even mention it.
Okay. So you're hoping this just slides through.
Yeah.
I don't know that I don't know if that gives me the warm, fuzzy feeling that I'm hoping for.
Yeah. I wished my answer was different, but I do think that's a possibility.
Right. But, you know, also to your point about, you know, this rule was written back in 1938 where people were institutionalized. The work was much different then too, where people with disabilities weren't really as valuable because depending on your disability, the work was heavy physical manual labor. And a lot of people with disabilities couldn't participate. So the arguments were different then. The work is a lot different today. A lot of it's computer-based. A lot of it's, you know, pushing keys and moving things around like that. So I think the workplace has opened a little bit more than from back then. Or no? You think I'm mistaken?
I don't think you're mistaken. I also think for some people, I don't want to speak for all disabled people, but for some people, having quota-based jobs can be very difficult. Work in these sheltered workshop is essentially a quota-based job. You need to put a certain amount of things. But in some ways, doing some computer-based jobs might be a lot easier, or even packing bags at a grocery store. That could be less anxiety-inducing. It could be, for some people, a lot easier and a lot better while making minimum wage, which is not enough. definitely a lot of states.
Yeah.
Or no, even in most states, it's not good, because also having a lot of health issues, which a lot of disabled people do, it can be a lot more expensive to just live than for non-disabled people. So there's definitely a path forward, and I am hoping this rule slips through.
Well, it's something we will be most certainly keeping a look at, and as it continues, I hope you'll come back and keep telling us that they've forgotten about it, in hopes that it gets put through. But Julia Metro, I appreciate your time. Great piece. Hope folks will take a look at it. Your work over at Mother Jones Magazine. Good stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Julia Metro, reporter there at Mother Jones. Make sure you check out their website, motherjones.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Any thought, any hope that Trump will miss it? Any thoughts on the proposed labor secretary? rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around.
From Ashwaubenon to Alloway, this is 97.9 WGBW. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy and cold tonight, a low in the mid-teens. And a mix of sun and clouds for your Friday afternoon, a high in the mid-20s. Warmer for the weekend and a partly sunny sky, high in the upper 30s for Saturday, mid-40s for Sunday. Currently 21 degrees.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
James Rundy.
I decided to throw off all my wild and crazy short film ways and make a straight up documentary about my uncle. He was one of the small time dairy farmers across the state that were kind of the backbone and why we got our state's name, America's Dairyland.
It was called The Last Milk. Have you ever milked a cow?
Oh yeah.
I'm curious, but I'm scared to do it because I'm worried I might like it.
All right. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the years, you know that on this show I've talked about how important I think the Pennsylvania state system of higher education is for working people in my home state. My wife, for instance, graduated from a state school and did so without debt. She worked summers at a local grocery store, had a little bit of savings when she was in high school, and walked out with a degree, a four-year degree, and no debt. That was back in the era where taxpayers paid about two-thirds of the cost of tuition, and students paid about a third. We are now completely upside down, where last time I heard, students are picking up about three-quarters of the cost, and, well, we've got the state running away. And look, I've said before, I think this was and could once again be the crown jewel of education structures in this country. But that said, between our Pennsylvania Republican Party's tax cut fetish and their privatization fantasies, one of the Commonwealth's greatest assets is in turmoil. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on now and why this is just not a good thing to have happen, I've asked Eric Haverlack to come talk with us. Eric is the Bloomsburg chapter president of the Association of Pennsylvania State College and University Faculties, APSCUF, APSCUF.org, their website. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's going on? Look, I look at the universities that are owned by the state to give working class people an opportunity to get an education as incredibly important. Why are we having such problems?
Well, Rick, I'm going to start off by agreeing with what you started with. I think at the top of this, it's a political agenda, particularly for the Republicans. They don't want to support education anymore. They don't see the value of it. If you kind of want to go maybe the conspiracy theory kind of route, if you can keep your electorate at a lower education level, then you can get away with more. And, if public education is a way to, bring up the lower class, those that don't have the money to pay for a private institution, if you can harm them, then you can, keep the people uneducated. So they're not supplying the money that needs to be supplied. they've taken on the business model. I mean, if you look at, you know, our former chancellor, Dan Greenstein, would use the term CEO when he talked about himself. That's not an education term. That's a business term. You know, when you look at, you know, the various positions at our universities, we have somebody that is known as the vice president of finance is the education term. But, you know, they like to refer to them as a CFO, which, again, is a business term. You know, they talk about our students as being the consumers and not as being, you know, learners. And so they run it like a business. And if they can't see a profit coming from it, then, you know, there's no reason to do it. But education is supposed to be an investment. The end of it is having a well-educated populace, having doctors and lawyers and CPAs and, you know, other educated people that can help society. It's not how much money can, you know, a university bring into the state. So, you know, that's the number one thing I think that is happening, is that you have this from the top at the legislature, you know, not willing to provide money for it. Yeah. So then that causes problems as you work down the chain. So within the state system, we have our Board of Governors, which, you know, governs over the entire system, because the system now is currently 10 universities across 14 campuses because of the consolidation process, which I'll get to at some point, I'm sure. But now when you look at the Board of Governors, you know, they're trying to use the allocations that they're getting from the state, and they're trying to keep a good public image. So for the last 8 years, we've had no tuition increases. And while, again, that looks great and to the public, when it comes down to how do you run your university, let's face it, in the last 8 years, the prices of everything have gone up.
Sure.
And so if we're not bringing in more money and the state's not giving us any more money, we're losing money. Okay. And so that then kind of brings us to where we are here at Commonwealth University. And, you know, you introduced me as being the chapter president at Bloomsburg, and that is correct. I am the chapter president at the Bloomsburg campus of Commonwealth University, because Commonwealth University was one of the two newly created, through a consolidation process, universities within the state system, where we took the former Mansfield University, Lock Haven University, and Bloomsburg and combined them into one, which we now call Commonwealth. And we're in a huge budget crisis. We ended last year, the last number I heard was $32 million in the red. We projected a budget that was approved by the Board of Governors with, as far as I know, no questions asked, at least no questions publicly asked, you know, a projected deficit of $13.6 million. We're projecting a deficit next year of over $7 million. And we're finally, they're claiming that they're going to balance our budget in about 3 years. But in the process, we're going to spend $70 million of our reserves. You know, so it comes down to, and it's sad to say, but there's not enough money in the system to do what we need to do. Right. And it's ultimately hurting our students, and it's hurting the people in Pennsylvania.
Well, I think all this is by design, Eric. You know, maybe I'm with you a little conspiratorial, but it seems that by defunding, you know, and I'm reliving a lot of the Corbett administration in my mind right now. A lot of the defunding that happened, especially during his term, the idea that we're going to commodify education, that the only reason that you get an education is to get a job, is ridiculous. I think of my wife, who graduated from a state system school, like I said, with no debt, got a four-year degree, never quote unquote used her degree, but was a very educated, critical thinking, thoughtful, caring person, a good citizen, which is what I think education ultimately we should want out of. Yes, a career path, all of that, but also a good citizen. I think that's part of what's in it for me. And it seems to me that if we're not going to prioritize that in our funding of certain things through our government, we are certainly heading down a wrong path.
You said something absolutely important there. It's the idea of critical thinking. I mean, that's really what it's about. And again, you know, with our former chancellor, we would often hear when he talked about, you know, making sure that we cater to the job market, making sure that we cater to the, you know, the employer's needs. Yes, there is some of that. I understand that. But, and again, I'm not disparaging, you know, other institutions, but there are technical schools that do that. You know, there are vocational schools that do that. And again, I'm not disparaging those people. I have great respect for people that are plumbers or that are electricians. My stepfather was a master electrician and a union member for many years before he retired. And I had the ultimate respect for him because he put in a hard day's work and he did something that, frankly, I can't do.
Right.
And I don't want to do.
But if I could cut you off here for a second, I don't remember when that it was sometime in my school years that this flip happened, that the only reason you get an education is to get a job. It used to be, and I have friends a little older than me that remembered getting out of college with a liberal arts degree and then heading to an employer, and an employer, this is the weird part, an employer training them for their needs instead of the tax base, the citizens training workers for employers' needs. Employers did that. When did that change?
You know, I don't know exactly. I mean, I'm going to put it probably, I think it started in the 80s.
My high school years.
You hear from the Republicans all the time, you know, beyond now Donald Trump seeming to be the new Messiah. You know, Ronald Reagan was the, you know, the golden icon of Republicanism. And, you know, if you look back at what he did, he started us on a lot of bad paths. I mean, obviously cutting the high end tax rate, you know, I know Lyndon Johnson was the first one that actually started to raid Social Security, but Reagan, you know, made it a new art form by taking money out of Social Security and, you know, running up deficits and all of that. And I think that's where the shift in the education started, because, again, we didn't have the money that we had before to put into education. And when you're trying to figure out where can you cut, education is the way to do it. And, you know, I've heard people talk about, you know, we can't allow students to just and to, you know, kind of paraphrase what I've heard in the past, graze in the meadow of education and just continue to learn. We need to focus them on a career and get them out. You know, so I think it kind of started in the 80s and really picked up steam in the 90s and has just continued as we go on, as we continue to defund. And again, you've got to get people in and out because we can't afford them. They can't afford it. You know, the other thing you talk about along those lines is, you know, you mentioned that, you know, when your wife went to school, obviously it was cheaper and there was a lot more money involved, but she didn't have to work a 40-hour week while she was in school. You know, I think I heard you say that she worked over the summer and she saved some money and then it helped her get through the year. I did a similar thing. I mean, I had a lifeguarding job in college because I was a swimmer and a lifeguard. But look, most of my lifeguarding time was sitting on the pool deck doing my homework because nobody came to use the pool. All right. But I worked in the summer and I was able to use the summer money to help pay off my tuition. And I came out with very little debt, more than your wife, but very little, nothing compared to what students are doing now.
Right. But it's that building that's happened. Look, I keep going back to this because I have friends of my age who are, you know, just dead set against debt forgiveness for students. And I'm going, I don't think you understand this transfer that's happened, this massive redistribution of wealth that's happened. And we've saddled a generation of students with an incredible amount of debt because as governments, as the Republican Party has sought to defund education, they've done it on the backs of our children.
Yes.
And this is where we are. So I do want to come back to what I brought you here is because I understand there's a vote of no confidence coming very soon in this situation. Can you walk me through that? Because obviously your union, APSCUF, is taking a very aggressive defense of your system, advocating for not only your members, but also the students. So I think this is kind of an important part of this as well, because in most places that don't have unions or representation, we don't get to find out until it's already done. So walk me through what this vote of no confidence is.
So at this point at Commonwealth University, to put it very broadly, we're upset with the administration. I mean, we're upset with the administration at Commonwealth. We're upset with the way the Office of the Chancellor is, you know, kind of running the system also. But when you look at Commonwealth University, our current president is Bashar Hanna. And the decisions that have been made since consolidation have happened have not in any way alleviated the pain of consolidation. I mean, I've already kind of mentioned it. I believe I did. The biggest issue is $32 million in debt last year, you know, projecting $13.6 million this year. I'm going to be honest. I'll be shocked if it's 13.6. I think it's going to grow. And they're going to immediately tell us that, you know, it's a consolidation issue and that the system didn't give us enough money to handle the consolidation process. And I'll give them some cred for that. There's obviously some truth to that. But we've been in this process for 3 years. We found issues in the first year and we haven't fixed them. We, you know, found new issues in the second year and we haven't fixed them. And we find new issues now here in the third year and we didn't fix them. So the issues just continue to pile up. Obviously the budget is a huge problem, but our whole registration process for students is a tremendous problem. Our, you know, students being able to get classes is become a huge problem. Our, the number of staff and faculty that we have on our campus is become a huge problem. One of the interesting kind of, I guess, dynamics we have going on right now, and this is where I think everything kind of came to a head. In the spring last year, in late April, at right towards the end of the semester, it was announced that we were going to consolidate our departments. We had 28 departments at the time. We were going to consolidate them down into 18 departments. And then we were going to consolidate our five colleges into three. So I was originally, no, actually, when I started 21 years ago, I was in a chemistry, biochemistry department, which is a natural, I think, union there. A couple of years ago when consolidation happens, they brought physics into us. And so we became physics and chemistry and biochemistry. It's not a huge stretch because we have physical chemistry. It is a bridge. Okay, fine. But with this reorganization, we got geography. Okay, not disparaging my geography faculty, but I don't really see how geography ties in to chemistry. I'm in a lab usually. I'm not worrying about geography. I go to my lab, I work in my lab, I leave my lab. And we also got geoscience. Again, not disparaging my geoscience faculty, but don't really see how it ties directly to chemistry. But they consolidated our departments. Their rationale behind it was we need to get quality faculty back into the classroom. And the what that meant was we were eliminating department chairs. We were eliminating assistant chairs. Those department chairs and assistant chairs get released from teaching, so they're not in the classroom. So by eliminating them, making departments larger, you're putting people back into the classroom. The reason for this is because we frankly don't have enough faculty to teach the students that we currently have. Then in our new contract that we just ratified last spring, there's language in there about additional assistant chairs that can be granted, but it has to be, you know, kind of negotiated locally. There are some outlines that you can use, but there's a local negotiation that has to go on. So we've been doing that local negotiation. And obviously the faculty are trying to get as many assistant chairs as we can because the burden on the chairs has just gone up over the years. And the administration is trying to limit the number of assistant chairs they're willing to give, again, with the rationale that we need to keep quality people in the classroom. So that's one thing. They're saying cloudy people in the classroom, quality people in the classroom, make sure that we can handle our students. But we're also talking about retrenchment. Okay. And I'm sure you know what that word is, but maybe for other people that don't, retrenchment is effectively removing faculty tenure and removing faculty. It's firing faculty.
Right.
So at the first meeting that we had about retrenchment, and I know right now that my provost and my administration is probably freaking out if they know I'm talking about this because they keep telling me don't talk about it. But I was like, you're talking about it, so I'm going to talk about it. At our first meeting, I said to them, on one hand, you're telling us we need to get quality people back in the classroom. On the other hand, you're talking about taking people out of the classroom. What is the honest to God message here? You know, so we have no direction here at Commonwealth. We have a budget crisis. We have no plans to fix the problems that we have. And frankly, the faculty and the staff are fed up. And I know the students are. They're not as vocal as we are, but I hear from them. Students know who I am. They know my role. They come to my office and they talk to me. So all of this is just, it's been culminating for a long time. And when we first talked to a couple members of the Council of Trustees, just the chapter presidents, I actually presented it to them. I almost felt like I was a Nazi in that something bad happened and we accepted it. Something bad happened and we didn't say anything. And something bad happened and we didn't say anything. We finally got to the point where like, we have to say something. And the way I have said it to my students, because a lot of the students are like, well, why is this coming to a head now? We can't protect our students anymore. We were always able to do enough extra work, do this, do that to protect the students, but we can't do it anymore. We have tremendous wait lists for classes. Not just gen ed classes, but for major classes. Kids trying to go through their major in a prescribed manner to graduate in 4 years can't do it because you take a first semester class, but you can't get the second semester class. You're going to have to wait a semester or wait a year. But then you have the system crying, why aren't these students graduating in 4 years? Well, because we don't have the classes, because we don't have the faculty, because we don't have the staff. So it's gotten to the point now where we can't even protect our students anymore by us doing extra work.
Correct.
So we're done.
It sounds
something
like,
has to change.
Again, I go back to what I said a moment ago. It sounds like this is all by design, that it's set up to fail. And you know, from the beginning, and this comes back down to our policymakers, because, you know, if you want to solve your course problem, you add more professors, you put more, you get more classes in. If you, I keep hearing about there's an enrollment problem. Yeah, because the tuition's too high. If you want you want more people to come, you want more students, lower the tuitions, give more people the opportunity. Seems like a political thing more than an actual physical thing. It sounds like our political leaders really have done this. And so what can we do? What should people do, like in Pennsylvania or in other states across the country who have similar situations going on? What's the action for me personally?
Well, you have to look at the candidates. I mean, and I don't want to oversimplify, but I'll start by oversimplifying it, okay? Because you've said it a couple of times. We got to vote the Republicans out, okay? That's kind of the simple answer. But all Republicans aren't bad,
right?
Okay? We had a Republican legislator for the first about 18 years that I was in this district by the name of David Millard, and I'm going to give him the credit for it. He was a Republican. The one thing I always disagreed with David Millard is he always voted on the Republican budget. But when anti-union labor or legislation came up, David Millard would do everything he could to make sure it never came out of committee, didn't get to the floor, didn't get voted on, all right? Because he understood that there are unions in his district and they are driving forces for the economics of his district. And so he did what he could to protect them. So I will give him credit. So kind of in my mind, he was a good Republican. All right. And again, I'm not trying to disparage Republicans, but I know I am. But you have to look at, you know, what are your candidates, what are their views on education, and what do they feel? If they're looking at that privatization is the way to go, you know, we're spending too much money on education, then it's not somebody you want to be voting for, because public education needs to be funded by taxpayer money.
Yeah, no.
Okay. That's simple. As for the people that are already in office, we have to lobby them. We have to, you know, get people to talk to them, get them to realize that this is a priority. And if they're not willing to make some changes, then we have to look at trying to vote them out.
There you go. Ultimately, it comes back to us and the priorities as citizens that we make. Eric, I appreciate the time. I wish you guys the best. Keep up the good fight. And I hope to talk to you again sometime soon.
All right. Great. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much, Eric Havelak, president of the APSCUF chapter there at Commonwealth University, formerly Bloomsburg University. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Does this sound crazy? Or is this the future? Is this what we're going to see all across the country? I want to hear your thoughts. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1944. That was the day that seven employees at Detroit's Dodge truck plant stopped working to protest the firing of a union brother. When five of the seven were fired for the stoppage, it sparked a wildcat strike. Another 320 workers downed their tools and left the plant. It was World War II. The Dodge truck plant had been converted into wartime production. Workers there built heavy trucks to ship to allies in China. The unions had signed on to a no-strike pledge after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt demanded labor peace to aid the war effort. Leaders of the AFL and CIO agreed to no strike, no lockout clauses. The CIO went even further and agreed to give up overtime pay. Most union members were not consulted on the pledge and did not vote on it. When they learned about the pledge after the fact, many workers who had just come off victorious organizing drives were in no mood to make concessions. They witnessed surging wartime profits for their employers and no cap on executive salaries, while they had to deal with wage freezes and rising inflation. Many were confronted with increasingly unsafe working conditions, violations of newly won contracts, and arbitrary discipline and firings. Despite the no-strike pledge, wildcat strikes were common. During the war, there were over 14,000 strikes involving more than 6 million workers. In 1944 alone, when the workers walked out at the Detroit Dodge truck plant, there had been more strikes in auto plants than at any other time in the auto industry's history. Workers found that short, spontaneous walkouts quickly resolved their grievances, regardless of the no-strike pledge.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Gotta tell you, we're gonna see a lot of these privatization schemes over the next couple of years. And, you know, talking with Eric there, it got me thinking and remembering back in 2010 when my state here in Pennsylvania elected a Republican governor with a Republican legislature. And, you know, a lot of the horrible stuff that they rammed through that, you know, have massive, massive ramifications today, especially for me now. The Medicaid changes they made were just horribly draconian and well, for working people, a major screw job. But you think of every one of these peeling back and shredding of the safety net, shredding of you know, programs that helped working people. The Republicans have been at the heart of it. And education was something that Corbett wanted to cut. Higher ed, if I remember, his first proposal was more than half. Wanted to cut higher ed spending by more than half. Stop and think about that for a minute. You know, we have redistributed wealth in a way that has saddled the next generation with more and more and more debt. And I think Eric laid that out pretty. My wife didn't have any student loan debt. He had a little bit. You know, his kids are going to have a little bit more. And here we've gone these last 30, 40 years to where it went to, you know, if you worked a part-time job, you could get through college with no debt. To now, good luck. That part-time job had better be at somewhere near the executive level. And we did this by matter of policy choice. The Republicans were hell-bent on it because, hey, got to cut those taxes. Got to keep the property taxes low. Got to give business, got to give the wealthy more. And we end up screwing the least able to defend themselves, students. And as Eric was talking, I was remembering that period, 2011 through 2015, and the rallies and the fights that went on during that period, especially over education. And, you know, I was thinking about, and I think I've told this story before. I was waiting, you know, for my turn to speak at the rally because they had asked me to come and talk about education funding and you know, rile people up. And I was talking to a kid who was just, you know, he had come to protest. And, you know, I was asking a lot of people, you know, why are you here? What do you do? And he told this story about him being the first in his family to potentially graduate from college. His grandfather had wanted to go to college, but, you know, didn't happen because, well, the old-fashioned reason, grandma got pregnant. So he took the job at the mill, made a good living, had good health care, retirement, all that stuff. They led a good, solid, middle-class life. Dad wanted to go to college, spent a year, then, you know, didn't happen. I think the same reason. He went to work at the mill. Led a very solid life. Good middle-class existence, good income, good wages, good benefits, living okay. This kid going, look, I have to finish college. This is my only option because there's no mill for me to go back to. There's no plan B. And his whole life, he was told, the only way you're going to get that golden ticket into the middle class is to get a college education and get some skin in the game, which means massive debt. And this has been the masterful bait and switch kind of game that conservatives and Republicans have sold a generation. You don't need those dirty manufacturing jobs. You can invest in yourself. Skin in the game. So take on a lifetime of student loan debt. And leave the wealthy and the corporate interests alone. And what we've done is we've screwed over, and we're going to do the same thing to K-12 education. It's coming very quickly. So I think it's important to pay attention to stories like this, because we're going to see this on a much grander scale during these next 4 years of the Trump administration. Bet your bottom dollar. If you missed any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. You'll find ours. I want to hear what you think. Something you said, I said, made you think, made you angry, made you mad, happy, sad, any of that. By all means, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. As always, great having you here. Appreciate your time. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.